Hello, and you're very welcome to episode number 17 of the Life Well Lived podcast with me, Shane Breslin. If this is your first time here, I'm so thrilled to have you. The Life Well Lived podcast is a series of interviews about navigating and overcoming the challenges of life, discovering our genuine true self and bringing that self to the world with confidence, and ultimately living a life of fulfillment, contribution and happiness. My guest on this episode is someone who has crossed my radar in Ireland so many times over the past couple of years that I just had to have her on. Amanda Delaney is a conduit and a trailblazer. She has a reputation for her ability to bring people together using her strong core values of love, sharing, and serving. One of her mottos is "Together, everyone achieves more," and she creates tribes of people who genuinely want others to succeed. As part of that, she's the founder of We Can and We Will, which is a series of events that helps to bring people together and grow a tribe of people who share similar values and a will to succeed in business by contributing to the world. In this conversation, we talked about many things, including the devastating impact of alcohol from an early age, the day she hit rock bottom and made a quiet but firm decision to quit drinking forever, how that decision gave her back the 7 days in every week, and what she's working on now that she has this extra time in her hands. We talk about the We Can and We Will movement, but where it started from and where it's going. And Amanda talks compellingly about what she sees as the biggest obstacles to success for so many people at the start of their business journey, and the practical steps that we can all take to overcome that obstacle. Amanda discusses her relationship with God and religion, how she uses fear for benefit, and the best time to make a yearly success plan. So thank you once more for coming to the Life Well Lived podcast for this episode. I really hope you enjoy it. I certainly did. So with that, on to the show and my conversation with Amanda Delaney. Amanda Delaney, thanks so much for joining me on the show. It's fantastic to have you here.
Thank you for asking me, Shane.
I'm really looking forward to exploring a lot of what you're up to and a lot of your story. You keep coming across my radar over the last 2 years or so. I think it shows you just maybe, it shows me two things. Number one, it shows me how busy you are. And number two, it shows me how kind of small a pool sometimes Ireland is when you get on that scene, or when you start showing up at events and you start seeing who's making waves out there. I've seen you crop across my radar, whether it's on Facebook or in real life. It's happened several times now.
Yeah, I think that's when you start putting yourself out there. As you said, Ireland is very small. And now when I turn up at events, even if I have booked in on my own, I tend to always know somebody there or somebody to recognize me from social media. And you touched on something there as busy. And I think that's the perception that we have. Yes, my life is busy, but it's busy and balanced. And I think the fact that I share my life on social media, it gives this, people say, where do you get the time to do everything? Well, we've given up watching television and we make adventure and we build memories. And then I believe, and anybody who follows me knows, in sharing my lifestyle with other people. And in return for that, then you inspire a lot of people.
Yes, absolutely.
To do more in their lives.
And I'm looking forward to getting into that, because I know that social media has been a big part of what you do. And I'm looking forward to exploring a little bit of that, of how you talk about what you do and also what you do and how you work with people. But very first question, gratitude is a big thing for me. And I remember about two years ago when I started on this journey, it was like, you know, gratitude was something like that was, it was like stones in my mouth. Like it was like how does that how does that work? Like that just feels stupid. But it is, I know that when I do practice it and when I do practice over time, it's very important for me. So, very first question, what are three things you're grateful for right now?
Even though you can hear I have a head cold, I am grateful for the rest of my health. I'm healthy. This will come and it'll go. But I think being grateful, I've seen a lot of people, you know, get sick or have illnesses through no control of their own. And I can see what it can do in people's lives. So one thing I'm always grateful for, Shane, and that's my health. Because it is true, when that goes, you know, I get very frustrated even now with this head cold. So I'm always very grateful for my health. I'm grateful for the people that I have in my life. You know, I have an amazing husband and he's so super supportive of me because I do go on harebrained ideas and, you know, I'm always doing different things. And no matter what I'm doing, he is solid as a rock. He's always there for me and the kids. And you know, I have a good team of people around me, I suppose, and I'm very, very grateful. I never take that for granted, that those people in my life are there to support me. And then I suppose the third thing I'm grateful for is myself, is believing in myself. That wasn't always the case. So I'm very grateful now that I am who I am. And, you know, I'm worthy of everything that, you know, all that stuff that I've learned that took me years and years to learn. I don't take it for granted, because I know what it feels like not to know who you are and be people pleasing all the time. So I'm very grateful that I'm now the confident person that I am.
Excellent. Congratulations on that, because it's a journey that that lots of us go on, and it's a journey that very many of us don't succeed in getting there. So it's fantastic that you're there and you're comfortable with who you are. And that's I'm a big believer in us as individuals and actually taking that exploration and self-experimentation and figuring out exactly what makes us tick. So tell us a little bit about, we'll explore that. So tell us a little bit about the Amanda Delaney of the past. You know, where were you? What's your background? What brought you to this point in time?
Well, I suppose I'm one of eight. So it was a busy household, and I left school at 14 to get a job. That's what most people did back then. And I suppose the reason I left school, and this brings forward into where I am now. When I was in the 3 years I was in secondary school, I never really fit in, Shane. So I didn't, you know, I stood with, say, the bullies. Not even the bullies, you know, the messers. And over here was the studious type of people. Well, I was somewhere in the middle, but I didn't have the confidence to stand on my own in the middle. I never knew where I fit in. So it was easier for me to leave school than stay there and do another 3 years, not knowing where I fit in. So I left at 14 and I went to work in a factory. And still, it took me years. I never discovered who I was. I went into that factory and, you know, I had many, many years of just living highs and lows, basically highs and lows, a lot of alcohol on board from a very young age, because obviously when you get a job at 14 and you're getting paid well, you've got access to a lot of money and nights out and drinking and everything else. So life became a whole whirlwind of years of this, you know, highs, lows, drinking, partying, depression and all that, you know, the noise. It was totally just, everything was outside of me, never looking inside, and just that darkness, you know, that just like you were falling into a dark hole constantly. But the light came then at the weekend when I was the entertainment, you know, I was the life and soul. But then midweek then was completely different. But when I left the factory, I had my first child when I was 19, and I left the factory not knowing what I was going to do. I suppose this was a big turning point for me. My friends had done a fitness course. Now, I was 12 stone, a heavy smoker, heavy drinker, couldn't swim, never vacated the gym for more than 3 weeks in a year. But my friends were fitness fanatics, and I knew the trainers who they'd done their course with. So with no other choice, I said, you know, I'm going to do that course. And I had to pick my mother up off the ground from laughing, because on paper, this was the most ridiculous thing ever, that Amanda would go and do a fitness course. But I did. It wasn't easy. As anybody who's done fitness knows, you know, I had left school at 14. Here I am at 22, having to learn anatomy and physiology, do projects, you know, get out on the field. We learned rugby, teaching lifeguarding, you name it. Like, it was 9 months. It was full on trying to get childminders, and everything was just, it was a tough 9 months. But when I look back, it was the best thing that ever happened to me, because that's where I started to learn communication, teaching. You know, I have that stickability, even the fact that, you know, I won't cancel anything unless my head is hanging off my shoulders. I have a good work ethic. But I got my head down and I left that after 9 months with Student of the Year. So my first time to achieve a recognition that I was proud of.
Fantastic. And I'm always, I think I was brought up to be very careful about asking a woman her age. But when are we talking about here? When you left school at 14, were there many people at that time living school at 14? Or what were you, was that quite an unusual thing back then?
No, there was a lot of trades around at that stage. So it wasn't that unusual to leave at 14. I think at that stage it was happening less and less, but it still wasn't like today. That would be an absolute no-no. It would be unheard of. But back then there would have been quite a few of us left, because, as I said, I went into the printing trade. I went straight into an apprenticeship. So the money was good in printing. There was more money in factories back then than there was in an office job, which probably at 14 is not a good idea to give somebody at that age that much money.
Yeah, and so walking into a job apprenticeship that was being paid well at 14, 15, 16 years old, you mentioned already that alcohol was a big part of that. I remember my first drink when I was 14. Alcohol was really pervasive presence all the way through my teens. Like, you know, it was, and when I reflect back, I'm like, Jesus, like what were we doing? Like, we were drinking in fields. I did have a first drink in a pub, and I drank in pubs regularly through my teens, but I also drank in fields. I drank with bunches of lads getting up to mischief. When I look back now, it was like, it feels crazy. And I've just finished reading Declan Lynch's book about Italian 90, and so it's like 30 years ago now, but like,
yeah,
alcohol, it's like Declan Lynch has spoken a bit about he's a Sunday Independent journalist, and he's spoken about his alcoholism, and that book, that like mid-80s to mid-90s, awash with alcohol. What are your own memories of alcohol and the part it played?
Devastation looking back. Like, at the time, I suppose you knew no different. There was a lot of alcohol in our house, you know, as there was in most houses. It was just the norm. I remember we went on holidays one year to Wales, and I went into this nightclub. I was 14. I had two older sisters, and they were stopped at the door. And my mother said to the bouncer at the time, she said, you're not letting these two in. These are the right age. My daughter's in there. She's 14. And he said, will you go and get her out? And she was like, well, no, you let her in. You go find her. I was in there happy out drinking at 14. It was just the norm. It was just the norm. But as I said, the norm became 3-4 nights a week. You know, it became more than the norm. It was ridiculous. It was ridiculous. When I look back, I don't know how I came through some situations in one piece at times, risk taking and everything, coming home, not knowing your own name. And this is something I talk about openly because, you know, a lot of us went through it. And so, and people say to you then, but sure, we all did it, but we all have our own scars from it. Do you know that kind of way? And that's what makes us unique, is what harm it done to us. Now, I couldn't see the harm. I'm doing no harm. I'm just out partying. But when you see the light shine and you come out of that darkness, you actually see that crying on your pillow, embarrassed to pick up the phone. Oh, what did I say to such a body? What did I do last night? That, or, you know, I had a great night last night. I don't remember a thing. Like, that was just, it's just insane. But that was what everybody did. It was a great night if you couldn't remember a thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And one story I sometimes tell, or a memory that I have in relation to alcohol, was back before my wife and I got married. So this is like about 2002, 2003 time. We traveled around France. We spent a couple of weeks traveling around France, like backpacking. And we ended up in a city, in the city of Montpellier in the south of France. And it was, you know, we were having something to eat and a glass of wine or whatever on a terrace, outdoor terrace, beautiful, beautiful city, beautiful, like, you know, city center terrace. And we saw this group of teenage kids, you know, maybe 14, 15, 16 years old, and maybe a group of 10 or 12 of them with their basketballs or skateboards or whatever. And one of the party was drunk and very, very badly drunk. But he was, the rest of them kind of treated him as a pariah. They kind of disowned him. They were like, you know, like, this is not the done thing. And when I was looking at them, I was kind of reflecting on my own experience, because when we were growing up, when I was that age, the drunkest person was the person everybody wanted to kind of, like, you know, it was like, you needed to be helpless drunk before people would kind of say, Jesus, that's gone a bit too far now. Like, you know, they've gone a bit too far, it just didn't happen. What you mentioned about the marks it left, or like what were the marks that those experiences left on you?
Well, I suppose when you're drinking like that, it's a false high, it's a false sense of who you are. So it's not really you. So you don't look in, you don't do personal development work, you don't take responsibility for anything. So I was a very sensitive person to be around. I was on watch because I'd be high and low, and people, my family could actually see when I was going to hit rock bottom before I ever could, because they'd see the signs in me. And you get a lot of attention when you're in that situation. And I suppose what I learned, and this is the marks, you learn to get validation or get attention from people for the wrong reasons. And that gets you stuck. Where when I met my husband and I got a bit of tough love from him, but I got consistent love, but I also got tough love. And that kind of shook me up and went, oh, hang on a minute, there's a different way to love. You can still love me even if I'm not a victim, even if I'm not crying in my pillow, or even if I'm not sad. But growing up, I would have remembered a lot of attention through my behaviors, leaving you very, very, you know, a very sensitive person that nobody could say boo to you because they didn't want to upset you. And that's a selfish way to be.
So, fast forward to now. What's your relationship with alcohol now? Do you have a relationship?
When I talk about it back then, it took many years. Like, I was married, and I shared this openly. Like, we were well married, and I was still not all the time, but still going out with the girls, thinking, "Oh, I can go out and have a party." Sure, I'm married. You don't own me. Still looking for that validation, being the party animal when I went out, causing an awful lot of hurt and upset. And of course, you know, on the other side of it, people are saying, ah, he's controlling you. And he's at home and he can't sleep because he's worried sick. One, the state I'm going to come home in. And two is, what is he going to face for the rest of the week? Because of my drinking. Because he knows I'll go downhill. And then your work suffers, everything suffers because it takes you 3 days to get over it. So that went on, and then I hit a period where I actually became a Christian. So I was going to church. Now, there was still Sundays, I was sitting there after having a few too many the night before, hanging. But 2 years ago, having spent 2 years not getting drunk, thinking, I have this, I'm in control of this, I'm going out having a few pints and going onto the water, and anybody who was around me would say, oh, Amanda's hitting the water, get me a glass of water. So it was known that I wasn't in that state anymore. Thought I had control of a chain until I went away with family to a wedding. And it was a 2-day event, lovely, sister's home from England. And I knew that summer I'd been drinking a bit more than, say, I had been in the past. It was creeping back in again. But that weekend I went back into old mode. So instead of coming home on the Sunday to the family and spending the bank holiday Monday with the kids and Ian, now Amanda rang and said, I'm having another night here. Used some BS excuse and got absolutely wasted. I came home with my tail between my legs the next day. And I remember that drive from Cork, sitting in the back of a car going, no, I can't do this. I really just cannot do this. I had done so much work on myself, so much self-development. I just wasn't that person anymore. So I came home. As you can imagine, the family were upset. I was supposed to bring Molly for a swim and, you know, spend time with my gorgeous family. And I just sat quietly on the couch and I made a quiet decision and I said, I'm done. I am done with this. And I said to Ian, I'm done. He says, you're done what? I said, I'm done with alcohol. He said, what? I'm not. Now, Ian's not a big drinker. And I said, I'm not asking you to. I sat with myself and took full responsibility for what had happened that weekend, for who I am. And I decided that I haven't got time in my life for three Amandas. There's the Amanda who's drunk and partying and being the life and soul. There's the depressed Amanda after the drink and the head is down. And then there's the confident business Amanda. And I said, no, it's done. And that day was August bank holiday 2 years ago, and I haven't touched a drop since.
Massive congratulations. And thank you. Thank you for sharing that story. It's why do you think do we all have different reasons for drinking or getting wasted and getting to that point? Do you have any kind of thoughts or theories around why we drink to that extent?
Well, I've been away from the scene now for a long time, but I, when I'm talking to people who are still drinking, I still hear the odd, "Oh God, it was so bad last night," and I can't remember a thing, and they're laughing and they're joking, and I think it's just, if you're in that culture, you know, if you're still hanging around with the people that are still doing that, that's very much the norm. Because I sat listening to a conversation one day a couple of months ago, kind of going, oh, I'm so far removed from that situation now that it's not my norm. But when you're in a situation where your life revolves around the pub at the weekend and you're with people who are drinking like this, that can be one reason. It can be social. You know, the other reason is maybe like me, for a long time, you don't intend to go out and get wasted. But alcohol has a funny way of getting that extra one into you and just going bananas then. It's that one too many. And, you know, as much as we try and control it, we think we're in control, but we're not.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's not dissimilar. We definitely had very, very similar experiences through our early years, I would say. Mm. I'm not off drink. I've had very, very little drink. I was very cognizant of the fact that at different times I drank for the wrong reasons. And I've not drank at home in maybe 2 years or so, or more than a year anyway. We haven't had any alcohol in the house, which I find a great thing, because it was easy to reach for that bottle when things became too much. So I still drink socially, but very rarely actually. But on a when there is an occasion, I do enjoy it, but I'm very mindful of that, as you say, that one too many, or that point that you come, that the top of that roller coaster, when you kind of go, okay, well, I can stop here, or I can go and I'm not sure what's next. And I'm not sure what's next. Yeah.
But what I hear a lot of people, and especially women in Ireland, when I did a video last year, when I was 1 year, now come here, I was nothing to do with this video. This was like, did I really do that? I was here on the anniversary of being 1 year off the drink, and something came up in my memories on Facebook, and that was Molly with a broken arm. And that was the year that I had gone on the mad one. And I promised her I'd come back, and she'd got her cast off just before I left, and I was to bring her for a swim. And when that memory came up in my social media post, I absolutely burst into tears. And something inside me said, go live now, or else this will not have the same impact. So for whatever reason, I picked up the phone and I went live. It was me at 8 o'clock in the morning, unconsolably crying with tears of happiness, you know, that I had, but also sadness that I'd let my kids down through alcohol. That video went on to impact so many people. And a lot of people reached out. And what I heard then was this: I deserve a drink. Having a glass of wine at the end of an evening because you deserve it, but knowing deep down that it's not the right thing to do. You know, it's not a reward. Alcohol is not a reward for, you know, living your life. In fact, when I gave it up, and I'm always saying this, I got 7 days of the week back. I can now do so. I don't know how I had time for alcohol in my life. I get so much more into my life in 7 days than I ever did even having one night on the drink.
Yeah, it's amazing. And that thing about deserving it, I went through that too. So the way I recall it is that if I had a great day, I would, you know, celebrate with a drink. I might celebrate with a drink, or stop off in Lidl or the off license on the way home. And if I had a terrible day, I would, like, you know, relax myself with a drink as well. So it got to the stage where maybe it was four or five nights a week was kind of having some sort of alcohol. And I was like, and both of those were for the wrong reasons, definitely. So so you mentioned about kind of having the 7 days of your life back for the last couple of years. So that has obviously led to different things. What have you been working on, and what are you working on right now? If you can distill it down into, I'm sure there's several.
You know, people often say I love doing lots of different things, Shane. I'm not the type of person that'll fit in one box. I'm passionate. I am a passionate person, and I'm passionate in a lot of different areas. So I did run my own beauty salon for years, and I closed that down. When I had my beauty salon, I went into network marketing. So I had a business there as well. Okay. Now, bearing in mind back then, I had these businesses, but I had zero business skills. Okay. So I'm just going to plant that seed. That's just where I was, right? So here I am running a beauty salon and a school. I was teaching because my passion was teaching. So I was doing that, found network marketing. So I was running with that as well. And there was lots going on. Now, I knew nothing about marketing, accounts, or anything to do with business back then. I was just, when I see something, I go with it. When I see an opportunity, I'll run with it. And, you know, that excitement and that passion that overtakes me. So I did that for many, many years. And then I started to step out and go networking. And very fearful. And a lot of people can resonate with this. I came from a working class background. My dad was a welder. My mom worked in the factory, ironically, that I had worked in. So we were brought up to believe that people in suits or people that had their own business was well for them. Okay, so for me, the impact of that as an adult was I had people in suits on pedestals that I was beneath them. So these networking events where people would be talking about, you know, in different, and really it's only their own language for their work, their business language, but I would be very intimidated. So it would take a lot of courage and a lot of guts for me to go to things like that and be very uncomfortable. So I decided then that I was going to set up my own meetup, my own network. And that's where We Can and We Will came. And that was 3 years ago. So I just invited a few people that I knew to meet up, and we decided then to run it every 2 weeks. And that was literally how that started.
So tell us about We Can and We Will.
We Can and We Will. So we were meeting every 2 weeks in the Red Cow, and occasionally I'd bring in speakers, and it was just attracting some great people. So what I found then was one day we were sitting there and there was seven of us. And I just, as I do, as I said to you earlier on, I speak from the heart. I very seldom plan what's going to come out of my mouth. And I just said, I'd love to get better at public speaking outside of my Forever Living business, because I'd done a lot of MCing and big stuff with them and I loved it. But I do know that you benefit when you move outside your comfort zone. I said, I'd love to do more public speaking. And five out of the seven of us said, me too. And I went, oh, so that immediately got me thinking. And that night I went over to the Bank of Ireland in Montrose to another event. And I saw the venue and I went, oh, this could work. This could be amazing. So I set up to meet the girl who was organizing the bank. And that was it. We Can and We Will Talk came out of just one conversation around the table. That's why I say the benefits of networking with people and, you know, just sharing ideas. And that was we celebrated our second birthday. So for every 6 weeks, I've been inviting four people to come along and share a story to inspire us, to give us knowledge. I don't pick the topics. I let them choose their topics. They get 10 minutes each. And to date now, I think we've had nearly 80 speakers. So that's 80 people have had an opportunity to either step outside their comfort zone. Some people have got some heavy stuff off their heart and shared it with the audience. People in the room are just inspired. They're networking. There's business being done. And I'm just, that's my why. See, when I see, you know, transformations being made just by giving someone an opportunity to share a story or step into their light, it's just phenomenal.
Fantastic. It sounds amazing. There is an appetite, right, for how would you describe it? Humanity, realness, authenticity. There's so much bullshit and BS around that there is an appetite for people to actually connect with people in a real way and to tell a real story, right, and to listen to a real story.
Yeah, and this is what when I send out the info for the speakers, I actually encourage them not to do a sales pitch. You know, steer away from that. And I ran a breakfast networking event, my first one there last month, and I said, leave your pitch at home. Come with your stories. Stories resonate with each other, not a pitch. You know, a pitch will tell me what you do, but it doesn't tell me who you are or how you can help me half the time. But a story, you can get into in depth in your story, a story about you or how you've helped someone else, how your product or your service has touched the life of someone else. That's what resonates with us.
Yeah, absolutely. We Can and We Will, is it open to anybody? It is open to anybody. So how do people hear about it, come along? How do they get involved?
We have a Facebook page, We Can and We Will, and it's always on Eventbrite. I decided then to run this year exclusive events every month. So we've had Jerry Duffy teaching, because obviously people want to get better at their skills for speaking. So we did two very successful events with Jerry Duffy. There's another one coming up this year. I've had Alan Hennessy in, looking at social media skills. But all of this is on my Facebook page, or check us out on Eventbrite. And I have a closed group on Facebook where we share weekly wins. And it's for business owners and for people who are on a journey of discovery through life.
That's a broad, there's a lot of people on that journey, right?
Yeah. Massive amount. And it's lonely when you're doing it by yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you have a vision or a plan or a grand ambition for We Can and We Will?
Yes. I'm at the moment, at the moment, my message is we can and we will. So that's, come on, you know, together we'll do it. And then what I find is when I work with people, they go, you know, I'd say, you can do this. And then eventually they say, I can and I will. Do you know? So that's where I'm going. I'm in the middle of finishing a 12-step program. And this is for people who have a passion and love what they do with their business, but don't have the skills, say, in the marketing and the different areas of their business. So what I've done is, I've taken everything I've learned for all the years in business, because I can only do things simple. Layman, give it to me that I can understand it, that I can implement it, because I've spent many years getting overcomplicated trying to learn different areas, and it's overwhelming, and I do nothing. And I spend a fortune, and I do nothing with it. So what I've done is I've taken all of my learnings into a 12-step program, and it's called Passion to Profit. So it's teaching the basics. We love what we do, but then we procrastinate in areas that, oh, I don't like to do that, and I'm not. And then this tape is running in our head, the imposter syndrome. How can I call myself a businesswoman? How can I call myself a businessman when I don't really know what I'm doing, but I'm just going to keep burying my head, and I'm over here, and then I can't get clients, and oh, maybe this business thing wasn't for me, and all that nonsense that goes on in our head. So I've decided that that will be the people I want to help. They're who I was, passionate about what I was doing, but not having the confidence in other areas.
So what are the blockers between, because I guess lots of people, there's some people that maybe don't know what their passion is, or maybe looking to find what a passion is, or they're testing the water with things. But I think there's a lot of people that like to do something, but they might see it as a hobby rather than a business. What are the obstacles typically that kind of get in the way of when people start out, or they're minded to start out, or interested in starting out, the steps from there to kind of profit and sustainability? What are the things that get in the way sometimes?
What will people think of me? Massive, 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 massive. It's the biggest block I see over and over and over. What will people think of me? What will they say? Who am I to do this? Do you know? And it's not what I found. It's not even people that don't know us. It's generally we're scared of the people who know us all our life. Mm. Do you know? And it's robbing people of doing, you know, I just say to people like, okay, so you decide that you love to do this and you're bloody good at it. So you not putting that out there and you not offering that to people, you're doing them a disservice. Because if you've got a good product or a good service that people need and that they require, and you keep quiet about it, those people will go and find someone else to fill that hole for them. And if you really truly believe that what you have is, you know, you're confident in it, you've got conviction that this will get results for people, and you don't say anything, well, shame on you, because that person might go off and go get fed to the sharks and not find somebody who could help them the way you could, or not find a product that was as good as yours. And why? Because you didn't say anything, because you were worried about what people would think of you. And I'm speaking that from the heart, because that's exactly what happened to me. I had this idea. People had told me for years, Mandy, you should be in mentoring coaching. And I was like, no, I've no degrees and I've no this and I've no that. And time and time again, I sat with people with coffees and I did this all day on the phone, meeting up with people, and I was doing it. But I had that tape running in my head until I put it out there, and then I went, ooh, and I panicked. And I just kind of put it out there once, and then I said nothing. And I watched two people that I deeply care about go elsewhere, and it wasn't for them. And that's when I said, get your act together and go and tell people that you can genuinely help them. Now, those people are now working with me and I'm genuinely helping them.
Mm-hmm. So what are the, so if that is the big thing in terms of that fear of judgment and that lack of confidence in putting yourself out there, what are some practical things that either you've done or you've helped people do or you've seen people do that kind of that build that bridge to help them get from that point where they're afraid to put themselves out there to the point where they're actually delivering something and people are paying them for it?
Yeah, I'm going to give Jerry Duffy the credit on this. I'm working with Jerry for a long, long time. And years ago, I remember Jerry asking me to write down, I was in a room full of people, and he asked us to write down, I think it was 3 or 4 things that we were most proud of, and then to rate them out of 10. Okay, now what happens there is, say for me, it was having a child at 19 and going through that fitness course, trying to get childminders and, you know, learn to swim and all of that. It was massive. That was like a 9 out of 10. It was huge. So then when I look at where I want to go, how scary is what I want to do compared to what I've already achieved in my life? So give yourself an evidence card to say that you possess so much power within you because you've already done some great stuff in your life. That was hard. So in comparison to that, how hard is it to offer people what you have?
Yeah, that's powerful. And Jerry's amazing. And again, when you talk about story and the power, the importance of story to build rapport, like Jerry, I don't think ever pitches himself. I don't think he ever kind of sells himself or pitches himself. And he's just, his own personal story and his own personal connection, the way he builds rapport with people. He's just a really, really genuine guy.
So gentle and charismatic. He's just, I love working with Jerry. He's fantastic. But that, you know, you have things like that. Like there's probably lots of things like that. And I never claim, when I find something that someone's taught me, I'll always give credit. Always give credit where where credit is due. Never try and take stuff for yourself. Be real. I'm very grateful for everybody who's taught me stuff like that. Those little things that matter. So I've just taken, that's just one example. So I take little snippets like that to help my clients then to come out of the gates and actually stand proud and do their business.
Yeah. And the 12-step program you're putting together, the concept of 12 steps is brings to mind alcohol and Alcoholics Anonymous. Is that intentional in a way?
No, not at all. I've been very lucky. And, you know, some people said to me that I should set up this 1 year no beer and do events like that and all. I've no interest. I'm a firm believer go with your gut. And that just does nothing for me. I've never done a 12-step program. I do believe in God. And I was praying at the time for my addiction to be taken away. But that was for my cigarettes.
Mm.
And then all of a sudden, the alcohol was gone. Mm. So for me, I don't think I could genuinely help people who want to give up drink because I found it easy. It was like my faith kicked in and it was just taken away from me. I have no desire. So I couldn't have empathy with people who are struggling to have a drink. I wouldn't know what that's like because I really have given it up.
Yeah. And what does God mean to you?
Peace and a friend. Do you know, I spent many years with this, my head telling me all sorts of nonsense and understanding that there's somebody higher than me that has created me, that knows me deep inside, knows my thoughts, knows my future, knows where I'm going. He gives me strength that I can just lean on that person when I'm tired, when I'm worn out, when I'm happy. Do you know that that's the solidarity that I have in my life, that whenever things get bad, it's there. You know, it just gives me so much peace knowing that I'm not alone.
And were you mentioned you became Christian at a point in time. So this wasn't something you always had, or was there
that connection? No, come here. I always knew there was a God there, but I wasn't one for church or I wasn't one for, you know, actually Ian, my hubby, would have been more of a believer than I was. I just grew up as a Catholic. So he kind of knew from a young age that there was God, but I didn't know God.
Mm.
I didn't know God. And it's funny, I went to this church this night for a nose because my friends had gone and I said, I'm not going there. That'd give me the heebie-jeebies. I'm not into that. I was a real skeptic. And I went in one night because they were coming back with reports of, you know, good stuff. And I was like, I'm missing out here. The next time you're going there, give us a shout and I'll go. And it was the fear of missing out that brought me in that night. And I just got an overwhelming sense of you're home and you're safe. And it was then that the depression started to finally lift. That's only 9 years ago.
Right,
you know,
right.
Mommy was the young baby. So it's only about 8 years ago.
And do you go to a particular church or is that something you talk about?
Yeah, we go every Sunday morning. It's funny. That night I was like, oh, jeepers, how am I going to tell Ian? That, you know, that fear of what will people think of me? So here I am, you know, feeling this great feeling. And I'm saying, how am I going to tell my family this now? And somebody said to me, it's not about them. This is your journey and this is about you. I came home that night and I was, you know, I could see the peace and everything. And I said, look, I'm going to go. I'm going to go here and I'm going to see what this is about and whatever. 2 weeks later, Ian and the kids were in the church and we've been going ever since.
Amazing. Fantastic. Well done on that. I've this I wouldn't even say love hate, just complex relationship with religion and with, like, I'm very anti dogma. I don't like telling people what to do. I don't like being told what to do or what to think.
Yeah.
But I do get great peace from being in churches, and that's doesn't matter what that religion is. Like, you know, that can be.
It's not religion. It's a relationship, and you know, God says, "Come to me like a child." That's all He wants. He just wants us to chat and hang out with Him and talk to Him and hand stuff over to Him. He doesn't want to see us struggling. Do you know, a lot of stuff is man-made. You know, it's just made up. But He doesn't. Like, if I don't go to church, I don't beat myself up over it. I can chat to Him anytime. The church brings me peace. I love the music, you know, and the children go upstairs and they're learning, you know, different things. But there's other stuff I can take or leave. I'm not into, don't tell me what to do. But when I read the scriptures and I read the words of the Bible, it gives me peace. It gives me peace. To me, it's the best self-development I've ever gone on. It's the only one that has actually knocked the depression on the head. You know, I do believe that giving up the alcohol, it was bigger power than me, because most people I know give it up and struggle. I never struggled. It was just gone. It was taken from me.
That's interesting. And you've mentioned depression a couple of times. What did depression look like for you? Because I know from my own experience and from lots of other people I've spoken to, everyone has different experiences and different memories. How did it manifest itself on a kind of when it descended for you?
Oh, it would go through, I'd go through weeks where it'd be okay. And then when it hit, it could last for months. It could come and go for different reasons. Sometimes no reason at all. It would just, like, I remember getting my first car. I was in my early 20s and I should have been elated. And I was just numb. It was just this numbness. No, not happy, not sad, just numb. Not being able to associate with feelings whatsoever in any shape or form. Crying, not good enough. Another memory that sticks out for me is driving down the road, down the Green Hills Road here where I live, and I looked over and there was two junkies walking down the road. They were absolutely out of it and thinking, oh my goodness, I'd love to be them right now. Just to escape the voices in my head that were so negative. You're not good enough. They'd be better off without you. All that nonsense that was going on in my head. And I remember just looking over at them. I can still see as clear as day going, oh, it's well for them. I'd love to be in that position. Just to shut the noise up. It's exhausting.
And those voices in your head, do they come, do you think, or what's your thoughts? Do they come from conditioning or environment or habit, or is it something that kind of is a human thing that we all have to overcome?
I think it's a human thing, but growing up for me, like, there was eight of us, you know, there was, all of us took a different road from our childhood. And then now I take responsibility for my own life. I don't look back. But I suppose my insecurities came from being brought up in a house that was insecure. My first memory of depression was I was about 12 or 13 coming home from school. Just this sadness came over me, but it just didn't leave. And I suppose I never looked at it. Nobody talked about personal development then, or looking inside yourself, or even going to counsel. My poor mother didn't know what to do with me. Did something happen to you? What did somebody do to you? And they didn't have any answers. It was just, oh, I don't know what to do with her. Just leave her alone. I was constantly from a young age running away, and, you know, but nobody knew what to do with you. Only sit there and hug you and everything. But that was, I suppose, the wrong thing to do, because it just kept me trapped. I learned that when I was sad, everybody would love me. And when I was happy on a high drinking, I was the life and soul. And somewhere in between was that black depression, because I didn't know. I didn't have any tools to look inside myself or know that I was worth more than all of this craziness. They did try and put me on medication, and I took it once and said, no, that's not for me. So I fought every step of the way myself.
Yeah, interesting. It's I've on the medication side of things, I've spoken about it a bit, and it's like it's very, very complex. And I know, like, several people have said to me, like, you know, they wouldn't be here without medication, and that's absolutely fine. That's their story. That's what's true for them. And for me, it was I was recommended, like, first protocol without any other questions. It was like, you know, take medication. And it was like, no, it didn't feel right in terms of, it wasn't an anti-medication thing. It was an anti-process. Like I just didn't believe that this was the right process or the right way to do it. And I've also seen lots of people close to me have spoken about it. The side effects of medication, and the real struggles and troubles that people have getting off the medication after a period of time, and it's, they almost feel that kind of that trap, or that it is, whether it's an addiction, it's certainly, there are lots of side effects when you try to leave that medication behind for a lot of people. So it's interesting to hear somebody else's perspective, I guess, on medication. We've gone down that tangent. If we bring it back, and it's been great talking to you, Amanda, and I admire your candor and your honesty and your energy and your vibrancy, because you definitely are, I think it's fair to say, you're showing up in the world now in a way that's so you and so honest and so true, and I admire you and I commend you for that. What if you were to finish with a few questions, what do you know now that you wish you knew when you were 21?
Trust yourself. Trust yourself and work on yourself every day.
Okay, next question. On daily routine, do you have a daily routine? Is routine important to you?
Routine is important. I'm not rigid. And even with the gratitude, I know when I do it, it works fantastic, but staying on the path of doing it. So I'm not going to sit here and say, oh, I have this great routine and I've read all the books, the morning routines and all that, and I know they do work. But I do have, you know, I do like to be productive during the day. I like to get my exercise in during the day. I like to have stuff planned in the diary the night before. It doesn't always happen. But for me, a good day would be somewhere where I've, you know, produced something, I've booked an event, or I have an event, or I've done a good training session in the gym, whatever. So that would be me having a successful day. An unsuccessful day would be when I've nothing planned and I go through the day and I go, could have made more that day.
Mm-hmm. What's the ratio in terms of, like, do you right now, are you mostly in the successful days, or do you still have kind of...
Yes. Because... in November last year, I had a vision for We Can and We Will for this year, and I spent a month planning and putting everything together for this year. So that really has helped this year being an awesome year.
Fantastic. And when did you, so that's an annual routine or an annual plan. What's your...
That was the first time I've ever put a big plan together. Normally I'm like out the gates and get an idea and run with it, and there's not much of a plan.
But it was, you were looking ahead for the year. So when did you do that ahead. In January?
Yeah, I wanted to get out the gates flying in January. That was my goal, to have a plan of action for the year and run out the gates when everybody was still asleep.
Fantastic. And did you do all that planning and prep work in December, or did you start that in
November?
November. Okay.
Yeah, good and time. Don't underestimate it, because it's not blooming easy. Do you know, it took a month to really ask honest questions. What do I want? What do I hope to achieve? Why am I doing this? And, you know, it did took a good month.
I think it's a good month to do it as well. Mm. It's like it's impossible to do anything really in December with.
And I recommend you don't switch off. Yes. Take December, chill.
And January can, everybody's doing this sort of thing in January, so January can kind of become overwhelming in a few different ways.
Yeah, so you come out going, "Hello, here I am," and everybody's like, "What? They're only waking up." It's brilliant.
Okay, I'm going to mark that into the diary. November 1st is the yes. a 30-day development plan. Fantastic.
Yes.
Do you ever feel fear? And if you do, what frightens you?
I do feel fear. Last year I did Todd's Leap. I jumped off a 20-foot free fall. And oh my God, did I feel fear. But I think I learn when I'm feeling fear. Like I tried to get off the edge of that about 10 times. Everybody's, "Come on, Amanda, come on." And eventually I asked myself the question, what are you afraid of? I was telling them how to jump, because you had to land a certain way. And every time I got to the edge of it, I couldn't. And I asked myself the question, what are you afraid of? And the answer that quietly came in my head was, what if I don't get it right? And I realized that I've been using that in a lot of areas in my life. So I think when we head fear, when we just face it, we learn and we grow.
So your fear of that was what's Todd's Leap?
Toddsleap is a place up in County Tyrone. So we did zip lining. It's like, it's an adventure place. And we went up there as part of like an overnight retreat to step into our fear.
Okay. And was the leap with the jump, was that a bungee jump or what?
No,
or what?
It was a free fall. So you climbed up the ladder 20 feet and it was like a bouncy castle at the end. So you had to literally just step off and jump.
Okay. Okay. And so your fear was not of hurting yourself, but it was a fear of not getting it right.
Not getting it right.
In front
not
of people.
Not being perfect. Yeah.
How do you weigh up opportunity versus risk?
How do I weigh up? Well, first of all, I'll always go with my gut. So, you know, I've always been open to opportunities and, you know, I've done countless businesses because when I see an opportunity, I'll go with it. Risk for me would be, you know, want to be financially, I suppose, as well. You have to think of your family. But another thing would be, would I risk, is this something people want? It's risky to go into an opportunity that's not what people want, especially, you know, people that you know that you're serving.
Mm. And so do you do some testing in terms of, do you just ask questions or how do you approach that?
Yeah. Like even with this program that I've put together, I did some surveys with people who would be potentially clients for me. And I also did some questions with clients that I'm working with. So I'm all about integrity and transparency. I didn't want to set up a website and put together a program that was coming from me. I wanted to genuinely hear what people want, what their fears are, and was this program on the right tracks? And I definitely was. But it feels more authentic when you do it the proper way and you ask the people. You're not presuming anything.
Yeah, and that again forces us to overcome that fear of what other people think, right?
Yeah. Mm. You're not thinking that. They're telling you.
Yes, indeed. So what's your definition of when I think of happiness, I think of effectively a life well lived where we can kind of be ourselves and be fulfilled and contribute and just have a life that we're happy with and proud of, and it's not about wealth and it's not about kind of all these things that we can amass. But what do you have a definition of kind of happiness? What is happiness to you?
Happiness is for me is when I've a balance. Now, I don't mean seesaw balance. We're never going to be completely balanced. There's times, and I'm always saying this, there's times in your life when you'll work hard more than you're with your family, and there's other times when you're with your family more than you work. But it's the overall balance of spending time with the kids and Ian, adventure, making a difference to other people. Like I'm doing the triathlon on Saturday. That's another out of my comfort zone. But my goal is to raise €1,000 for underwear for an orphanage in Haiti. Also this week now I'm collecting shoes for that orphanage and people will drop them to my house. So it's contributing, having time with the family and making a difference to people's lives with my business and my service.
Excellent. So that's fantastic. Does the concept of charity, is that something that you kind of plug into a lot of what you do, or is this the Haiti charity, is this something new for you right now?
No, again, through Economy Will, when I started it first, I met a guy called Joe Clancy, and Joe's a builder and he's an all out saint. He really is. And he goes over to Haiti. So he started sharing with us about the work he does here for the homeless and Haiti. So listening to him talking about the kids over there and the people who set up the orphanage, it just melts my heart. I'm not in a position to go there because I still have a young family here myself. So what I do is I get people, like one year we had 150 shoeboxes dropped here for the homeless in town. I got sleeping bags. So I'm like, I know my calling is not to go into the homeless. I wouldn't feel comfortable in there at all. I'd be way out of my depth. And I know there's people that love to do that. So what I decided to do was I use my house like a drop-in center. So people come and they drop their sleeping bags. They drop anything that I put a call out for. And then Joe comes and collects it. So that's the way I contribute. So this year is the triathlon. No way am I doing 5 months of training without it making a difference to someone less fortunate than me. And when I asked Joe what did they need over there, he said they're always crying out for underwear for the kids. They've got 400 kids registered in the orphanage, and then there's hundreds more come every day for schooling.
Fantastic. So this interview will probably be going live after your triathlon, but still, at this point, I'm going to wish you luck. I hope it goes Thank fantastic you. For you. I know it's your first one, so fantastic, and it's a great step, something I'd like to do as well at some point in the near future.
And you've told me now you will be doing it.
Absolutely. Yeah. I can't go back now. Nope. Final question, Amanda. It's been great talking to you. What are you most excited about right now?
Well, I'm most excited about right now is, I suppose, getting this website. My website's going to be called amandadelaney.ie. Like, I have the We Can and We Will one. It was a Mickey Mouse one made up. But this is hanging my face off my business and getting out there and helping people like myself who get what I'm talking about. Sharing my story of, do you know what? It's okay not to understand everything about your business and still do your business.
Yeah.
Do you know?
Yeah.
And that I'm super successful to, or I'm super excited to launch this 12-step program.
So where can people find out about this? Where can people connect with you?
I'm on LinkedIn, I'm on Facebook. I will have the website hopefully by July, August. It'll be all up and running. I'm more on Facebook than LinkedIn, but you'll find me on LinkedIn too.
Excellent. Well, listen, thanks very much, Amanda, for taking the time to speak to me. It's been a pleasure. I wish you the very best of luck with everything you've been working on and you're working towards. And given all that you've contributed and the impact and the presence you've had in the 2 years since you've had 7 days in every week, I've no doubt that we're going to be hearing a lot more about you in the future.
Definitely. This is only starting. This is the beginning.
Thank you for making it all the way to the end of the show. Shane here again with a couple of quick items before we wrap up completely. Thank you for listening to the show. I really hope you got something out of it. If you did, if there was anything in here of value, it'd be fantastic if you could, you know, take a screenshot, share this out on any of your social medias, wherever it is that you're most active, whether that's Facebook or Instagram or LinkedIn, just snap a screenshot or grab the link from the website and share it out there and tell the world what you found valuable in there. So if you want to check out other episodes of the Life Well Live podcast, they're all on whatever your podcast player is. So if you use Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts or Spotify or wherever it is, you should find the archive there. Alternatively, everything is available also on my website, shanebreslin.com. If you go to shanebreslin.com, there is a link at the top of the screen for podcast, and you will find the complete archive in there also. So thanks once again. I really enjoyed having you here. I enjoyed talking to Amanda Delaney, and looking forward to doing it all again with somebody else in the very near future. Thank you.